It's the Burt Cohen Show. Magic of history. History seems to change how we perceive actual facts of history. There is a certain magic to writing history, to having a memory of what becomes history. Whether or not it's really what happened at the time doesn't matter as much as how it is remembered. There was a wonderful book many years ago called The Great War and Modern Memory. Talked about how we remember the First World War and what it really was. It was quite different. Well, it is 150 years since early July 1863, and people are celebrating Gettysburg, the Battle at Gettysburg. What is that? What is it about? What is its significance? There's a lot to talk about, and I'm very, very pleased to have with us once again on the Burt Cohen Show, David Goldfield, author of the recent book, America Aflame, which I have to say is my favorite book about the American Civil War. What year did that come out, David? Was it 2010?
2011.
2011, yes. Very, very informative book. It gives you a really good picture of what that war was about. Far more thoroughly than normal. David Goldfield is the Robert Lee Bailey Professor of History at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. He's the author of many works and textbooks on Southern American history, including Still Fighting the Civil War, Southern Histories, Black, White, and Southern, and Promised Land, and, of course, America Aflame. As I said, it happened 150 years ago in early July 1863. Gettysburg is often called the high watermark of the Confederacy, arguably the Confederate Army's best chance of achieving victory in that war. Gettysburg, as you say, Gettysburg was a decisive battle because it was the last time the Confederates took initiative. After Gettysburg, the Confederate troops were so badly battered that the rest of the war was really a long, withdrawing roar, lasting 21 months. Never again between Gettysburg and Appomattox did the Confederates go on the offensive. And the so-called Civil War, I say it that way because a Civil War is two sides fighting for control of a central government. This was not that. It was a war against an independence movement, but it claimed more lives than all other American wars combined. Today, it's generally seen as a necessary and, in fact, ennobling sacrifice. The horrific realities through the years have been replaced by romance and glory. And I wonder, are we talking about this transformation of memory? Are we talking about something absolutely necessary for wars to be justified, that is a walling off to the horrors and instead emphasizing the nobility of sacrifice? Does memory require that kind of process, Professor Goldfield?
Walt Whitman complained after the war that the real war would never get into the history books. And for the most part, he was right. If you look at the novels that came out of the Civil War, with the exception of Red Badge of Courage, Stephen Crane's novel, and some of the short stories by Northern writer Ambrose Bierce, the horrors of the war were rarely depicted in American fiction. You have books such as Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, and, of course, the whole plantation genre tended to romanticize the war. I think you put your finger on it, Bert. Memory is very selective. And one of the things we do is to try to eliminate the horror and tragedy from that memory so we can move on. It's really a protective device. The problem with it is that if we forget the horror of war and the tragedy that it brings, we often repeat it.
Wow. Yes, so often we do. It does seem kind of essential. And as someone said, it seems that the only thing that we've learned from history is that we never learn from history. And, you know, it seems like on this, the 100th anniversary, we Americans are celebrating the glory of Gettysburg, which is the opposite of what we've done with many recent conflicts. We talk about Afghanistan, Iraq, even Vietnam, which is to question whether this was really a war of necessity, which justified its appalling cost. What happened to that questioning as to whether this horrible war justified its appalling costs?
Well, two things happened, Bert. One, the South tended to paper over the tragedy of the war, and the war was a tremendous catastrophe for the South, both in terms of loss of life and, of course, loss of property. And as I said, in order to move on, you develop a selective memory. And the selective memory in the South was the lost cause, that this was a glorious fight. The South was outmanned. The South was worn down by the North. But nevertheless, the South gave a great account of itself. There was a great deal of heroism and courage on the part of the Confederate soldiers, and they fought for a very important cause, and that cause was the Old South civilization, a civilization that was gracious, that was beautiful, and that was predicated upon white supremacy.
Right.
And Southerners attempted to restore that that after the war. But Northerners were complicit too. For one thing, they bought the plantation legend, and then by the 1950s and 1960s, historians began to look upon the war. Hey, you know, maybe the plantation legend is wrong, but the war certainly was important and necessary because it ended human bondage for 4 million people, and it saved the Union. Therefore, all that loss of life was necessary and contributed to the mending of our national wounds. Of course, that perspective leaves out the question, could we not have achieved those wonderful aims of liberating 4 million slaves and saving the Union without killing 752,000 men?
If you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is author David Goldfield, author of America Aflame. We're talking about a perspective on 150 years since the Battle of Gettysburg and, of course, President Lincoln's famous speech there. Certainly, the complexities of that war have long been reduced to ending slavery. America, as I understand it, is the only place where a war was employed to end slavery. If you could tell us about other alternatives that did work to end this evil. And as part of that, I also wanted to ask, this belief that it was about ending slavery, does this belief reflect how Americans actually thought during the time?
But let me answer that last part because it's absolutely central to the current discussion and debate about the Civil War. If you ask Southerners, particularly Southern leaders who led their Southern states into secession, why they seceded, they would tell you point blank because of slavery. They were worried about the Republican administration that was hostile to slavery, that would prevent them from carrying their slaves into the Western territories, and the widespread belief, which was probably accurate, that slavery would die and their great investments would be ruined if they could not take their slaves into the territories. So confronting a very hostile Republican administration that wanted to limit and ultimately end slavery, Southerners, particularly Southern leaders, took their states out of the Union. When they went around the border states, like Virginia and Tennessee, and North Carolina to convince those states to secede as well, they emphasized the danger of the Republican administration to the institution of slavery. And finally, Alexander Stephens, the vice president of the Confederacy, in an address accepting the vice presidential nomination of that new country, said that slavery was the cornerstone of the Confederacy, as was white supremacy. So there was no doubt, at least in the minds of Southerners at that time, what they were fighting for. Now, Northern soldiers didn't sign up to end slavery. Most Northerners were indifferent to the institution of slavery, and some, in fact, favored it because they were worried, 4 million black people coming north to take my job, to take housing, to take my daughter, and so on. They were just as well in the South. So Northern soldiers were not really interested in being a liberating army. But, of course, as the war progressed, liberation became one of the war objectives. So you have this odd complement here. You had Southerners fighting to preserve and protect and extend the institution of slavery, while Northerners joined up and invaded the South to preserve the Union.
So quite a bit different between the what we're told now about what it was about, and as you
this is one of the things that I think my book emphasizes, this idea of the Civil War as the battle cry of freedom, this war whoop that this is great because we're liberating slaves, not taking into account what you said early on, which is absolutely right, Bert, that we were the only nation to abolish slavery through a civil war. There were other precedents. There were legal means to abolish slavery. There were ways to compensate slaveholders. And economies changed. I mean, who could predict what might happen if there weren't, if it did not happen? The Civil War did not happen. Who could predict? You know, people say, well, slavery would have lasted a lot longer. How could you say that? You know, in the 1980s, we were saying that the Berlin Wall would never come down, and, and guess what? It did. One of the things that you know as a historian is that stuff happens, and very often that stuff is totally unpredictable.
Yeah, it certainly is, and there's questions about whether or not the soil itself would continue to be able to be so overworked, and that perhaps that factor alone might have affected slavery. And I also urge any people interested in this particular issue. Another great book is called Slavery by Another Name. I can't recall the author's name now, but it talks about how slavery actually went well into the 20th century. Fascinating book. The guy writes for Wall Street.
Yeah, that's Doug Blackman's book, and I would recommend that as well.
Yeah.
The fact was that 4 million slaves were freed, but they did not receive the basic rights of that freedom for 100 years.
Right.
And the question I raise, and I hope readers will raise as well, is could we have attained that liberation without the animosity and without the subjugation of an entire race for a century if we did not have a civil war?
Yeah, it seemed to me that as you pointed out in the book, that the anger that the defeated South felt whenever they saw a black person who reminded them of the devastation did not exactly help ameliorate what became Jim Crow laws, that had it ended differently, things might have been better for so many black Southerners. A lot of, you know, and there's really, in my opinion, nothing wrong with talking about what ifs. It's okay to look at history that way because things do turn on a dime. Let's face it. And as you point out, David Goldfield, Gettysburg was an accident. That's a quote. Gettysburg was an accident, and that shoes had a lot to do with it. Could you describe that?
Well, the Confederate Army was not the most well-equipped army in the world. They didn't really lose any battles because of lack of equipment, but the fact was most of the uniforms were sort of ad-libbed. If you look at photos from the time, not paintings, but photos, you will see an array of different uniforms for the Confederates. You know, Confederate gray, yeah, but most Confederates had a rainbow of colors on their uniform.
Right.
And many of them didn't have shoes. I mean, these were country boys. They were accustomed to go around barefoot, and they were certainly not accustomed to marching 20 miles a day. And that, even if they had shoes, that they would be worn down pretty quickly. A Confederate detachment, Confederate Army, the Army of Northern Virginia, Robert E. Lee's army, was already in Pennsylvania. And he sent a detachment into Gettysburg to look for shoes.
Hmm.
There was allegedly a shoe factory there. And they came across a federal detachment, not recognizing the fact that this federal detachment had behind it the entire federal army under the command of General George G. Meade. And thus began the Battle of Gettysburg, which, as I said in the book, was sort of an accident that had occurred right there. The Confederates, their objective really was Harrisburg, the state capital of Pennsylvania. In fact, the folks in Harrisburg were so frightened about the prospect of having Confederate troops descend upon them that they packed up the state capital and moved to Philadelphia. And after Harrisburg, the idea was, well, let's go south. We'll get Baltimore and invade Washington and the war. So this was a pretty serious deal and serious strategy that Robert E. Lee had devised. But the federal troops under the command of General George G. Meade cut them off in Pennsylvania at Gettysburg and engaged them in a very bloody three-day battle.
Yes.
And the irony of it is that Meade and Lee were classmates at West Point.
Hmm.
And just a week prior to the Battle of Gettysburg, Meade was not in command of the Army of the Potomac, the Northern Army. In fact, it was Joe Hooker, and Lee was just licking his chops. He said, "Boy, Hooker, we just triumphed over him at Chancellorsville in May of 1863. This guy is really a poor general. He makes very poor decisions." So Lee was very enthusiastic about his chances in Pennsylvania and eventually ending the war by sieging Washington, D.C. But then on June 27th, about a week before the actual battle of Gettysburg, Lincoln fired Hooker and named General George G. Meade in his stead. And Lee turned to one of his friends and said, this is not good news. I know Meade, and I know he's a good general. At least he won't make any harebrained mistakes.
Mm.
And that was true. General Meade did not make any harebrained mistakes. He was lucky in several instances in several places during the battle, but he did not make the type of mistake that General Hooker probably would have made in the Battle of Gettysburg.
And certainly, it appears anyway from this perspective that General Lee, who was an amazing commander, who his troops just loved him really. But he was steadfast in his belief that he must stand and fight at Gettysburg. I believe a quote is from General Lee, "I believed my men were invincible." Is that typical military hubris that didn't exactly serve General Lee well here?
It wasn't typical military hubris. That was Robert E. Lee. In all due respect to General Lee, if I were in that position, I'd probably think the same way. The Confederates had dealt a real stunning blow to the Union troops at the Battle of Chancellorsville in Virginia in May of 1863, and Lee believed that his troops could defeat the forces of the Army of the Potomac under the command of of General Meade. I think it's important for generals to have confidence because they extend that confidence to their men. But Gettysburg was certainly not Lee's finest hour by a long shot. Lee's problem at Gettysburg was not his belief in his men's invincibility as much as the fact that he failed to coordinate the attacks of his commanders. Now, after the war, a number of people blamed General James B. Longstreet, one of Lee's commanders, for being less than quick in getting into position and attacking Union lines. But in fact, coordination was always a problem on both sides. You know, they didn't have radios or walkie-talkies in those days. So battles were very confused. Sometimes you got friendly fire. Sometimes generals lost the division. They didn't know where they were. And it was almost impossible to know where the enemy was. So it made for a very difficult combat. And it tended to increase casualties because soldiers marched in very close formation. They did so not because it was a great battle tactic, it wasn't, but so they could hear the commands. And of course, when you march in close formation and you get hit with cannon fire, that can be pretty devastating, which of course is what happened during Pickett's charge on the third day, July 3rd. The penultimate and final day of the Battle of Gettysburg.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Pickett's charge. That's probably, if anybody, you know, non-historians know anything about Gettysburg, they probably will have heard of Pickett's disastrous charge. Now, did Lee, did he command that, or was Pickett just sort of a little bit, you know, off the reservation there? It was absolutely disastrous, no doubt about it.
Actually, Lee had commanded Longstreet to order Pickett to make the charge. So the order actually came from General James B. Longstreet. Now, what happened was, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon on July 3rd, the Confederates and the Union forces engaged in an artillery duel. And then a couple of hours later, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the federal guns went silent.
Right.
And the thinking was, on the Confederate side, aha, we've made a dent in their lines. This is the time to attack the center. Now, on the two previous days, July 1st and July 7th, Lee had tried to attack the the right flank of the Union lines on Cemetery Hill, and then the left flank. Both of these assaults were unsuccessful in dislodging the Union forces from atop the hill. Having tried the left and the right, General Meade figured that Lee would try the center on July 3rd, and he was absolutely right. And when you try the center, you're really trying the strength of an army's lines. And 15,000 strong, mostly Virginians, some North Carolinians, marched in close order, and their lines extended for a mile and a half. It was a magnificent sight, Bert. I mean, the Union forces on Cemetery Hill just stood in awe. The bayonets glinting in the sun and the faint strains of Dixie heard over the field, and these young men marching and then marching double time up the hill, many of them to their deaths.
Right.
And it was just a magnificent moment before a magnificent tragedy.
Yeah, it certainly was. We're talking about here the realities of 150 years ago, July 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg. How much did political considerations play into military decisions? Were they two separate things? Did Lincoln kind of let it go, or, you know, and leave the command to the military experts, or how much did political considerations play into these military decisions?
As the war advanced, Lincoln became much more of a hands-on commander. Now, he didn't really have any military experience. He had fought in a sort of ad hoc militia in Illinois in the Black Hawk War of 1836, but that really wasn't much of a military experience. But he was a quick study, and he understood the dimensions of warfare. And he understood, sometimes before his generals, that the key to winning a war is to destroy the enemy's armies. Not to take territory, necessarily, but to destroy the enemy's armies.
Right.
And he was furious mm-hmm. with General Meade on July 3rd. And in fact, he dashed off a letter to Meade saying, "Why in the world didn't you pursue Lee?" After he left the field of battle on July 3rd, after the Union armies were victorious by a very small margin, by the way,
yes.
Why didn't you pursue Lee and in his retreat back across the Potomac River? Lincoln never sent that letter, which is a good thing, or else mm-hmm. Meade certainly would have resigned. But it was testimony to two facts. One, Lincoln wanted to end the war as soon as possible. From a political standpoint, he understood that Northern public opinion was losing patience with the war. And there was a growing peace movement in the North that demanded negotiations without any stipulations, stipulation like the abolition of slavery. They just wanted the war to end, and they wanted the Union to be back together again. So there was a growing peace movement, and Lincoln understood that the longer the war prevailed, the more likely it would be that this Northern peace movement would grow. And he was absolutely right, because a year later, Union fortunes had not really advanced that much, and he was in danger of not being renominated by his own political party. So, definitely politics played a role in it, too. It played a role for Jefferson Davis as well. And sometimes he got impatient. He got impatient because he realized the longer the war went on, the less likely he would have support among the population. And that was absolutely essential, because most of the war, in fact, was fought in the South, and they required, they depended upon the support of the local population.
Certainly. And as you said, it was a close battle. Lincoln made a lot out of the North's victory, politically speaking. And, well, I have to ask, what if the South had won that particular battle, the Battle of Gettysburg? It was seen by the North as the turning point in the war, really the last initiative that the Confederacy had taken in the war. In what ways did Lincoln use the North's victory politically, and could he have picked, was it a little bit random? Was the fact that it was in Pennsylvania, which was kind of disputed territory? How much, I mean, was it a really big victory? It sounds like, yeah, okay, some mistakes were made. Did Lincoln kind of pick this arbitrarily and make the most politically out of it?
He really didn't have to make the most of it. The soldiers were the ones who did the interpreting on the Battle of Gettysburg.
Hmm.
And this boosted, this battle and their victory boosted morale tremendously. I would argue that the Union victory at Gettysburg was not that important strategically, but it was immensely important psychologically. What it did for the Union Army was to reverse a series of losses and stalemates, so that at least from their perspective, of course they couldn't know the war would continue for another almost 2 years, but from their perspective, this was the beginning of the end.
Right.
This was the turning back of the tide of the, as you put it, the high water mark of the Confederate Army and the Confederate influence in the North. Never again would Lee invade the North. So from a morale standpoint and from the Confederate point of view, if you read the diaries of their soldiers, and if you read the diaries of the men and women in Richmond and in Atlanta, you will see that they are now much more fearful. They are now much more pessimistic. And war generates a psychology all of its own. And the thing about Gettysburg was it generated such a positive momentum on the part of the Union Army, and especially when that was combined the next day, as July 4th, 1863, by the surrender, the Confederate surrender of the city of Vicksburg, the last major rail and transport port on the Mississippi River under Confederate control. So here you had, within a two-day period, two great Union victories, and these victories really boosted Northern morale and sent the Confederates not only into defeat, but into despair. And what it also did, it precluded, probably for all time, any notion that European powers would step in and either demand a truce or recognize the Confederate States of America as a separate country. So these two victories dashed that hope as well. But it didn't end the war, and that's the important thing to keep in mind. It pushed the momentum toward the North, but it did not end the war. And, in fact, a year later, by July 1864, it was not at all apparent that the end of the war was in sight. General Grant was bogged down in the siege of Petersburg, and General Sherman was marching toward Atlanta, but he was not having any success in engaging the Confederate Army under the command of General Joseph E. Johnston, who was making some very interesting and evasive maneuvers in Sherman's path.
There's so much reality about history that we just don't know, but it's really very important how things could have been different. Had the South, the Confederates, prevailed at Gettysburg, who knows what would have happened, of course. It obviously would have been a big boost in their morale. Maybe other European nations perhaps might have been more inclined to recognize them and help bring about some sort of a negotiated end. You know, in light of the amazing cost, the just unbelievable cost, could there have been a compromised, negotiated end to the war? Could the South have settled for a tie? And, you know, had there not been this huge victory, well, maybe not huge, but significant victory at Gettysburg, the peace movement in the North, might there have been some sort of a peace where the two of us, the North and the South, might, you know, we go our way, they go theirs? Could it have happened, do you think?
There was always a peace movement in the North, and it waxed and waned depending on the fortunes of the Union armies, as you might suspect. The high tide of the peace movement was in the summer of 1864. The Union armies were bogged down in Virginia, and it looked like there wouldn't be a resolution anytime soon when Sherman was trying to engage the Confederate Army under the command of Joseph Johnston in Georgia. So there was a growing peace movement, and this peace movement was primarily, although not exclusively, but primarily lodged in the Democratic Party.
Right.
In the summer of 1864, the Democrats nominated General George B. McClellan, who was an extremely popular general, popular among his men in particular. And this caused Lincoln a great many problems because when he fired Hooker, everybody expected him to name McClellan, but instead he named Meade, and this did not sit well with many officers and common soldiers in the Union Army. But in any case, in the summer of 1864, McClellan was nominated on a peace platform, and that peace platform said, among other things, that we want to sit down at the negotiating table with our Southern brothers and hammer out a solution to this. And there'll be no conditions, no preconditions to our discussion, meaning that the South would not have to say, well, we're going to give up our idea of independence, and we're going to give up our slaves. No preconditions. Just sit down and try to end this war. Let's have a truce, and then we can sit down and negotiate. And this was a very attractive alternative. The North was war-weary. Casualties were mounting, particularly since March of 1864, when Lincoln named General Grant as the commanding general of the Union armies. Grant's strategy was to attack the Confederates continuously. In other words, forget about losses of men. Just go after the Confederates in a relentless way, all-out total war. And the problem with that, of course, is that casualties mounted, and newspapers in the North were already calling Grant a butcher, not to mention what they were calling him in the South. So there was a great deal of war weariness in the North, and the time was ripe for a peace movement, a large peace movement. So the Republicans felt, hey, look, Lincoln can't be our guy. We're going to have to nominate somebody else, somebody either who's going to take a much harder stand toward the South, or somebody who is going to be more willing to negotiate. They weren't quite sure who that would be. One of the potential candidates was John C. Fremont, who was fired as a general by Lincoln, and who was the first standard bearer of the Republican Party in 1856. So not only was the Union cause in doubt, but Lincoln's own renomination was in doubt. But then, and here we go, Bert, with the contingency of history, then on September 3rd, 1864, General William T. Sherman wired Lincoln saying, Atlanta is ours. Sherman had conquered Atlanta, had taken Atlanta, and this was a major blow. I would argue that Atlanta is about as important as Gettysburg, because it did several things. One, it broke the most important rail connection in the South. Secondly, it led the way open to the breadbasket of the Confederacy, which was central Georgia. And third, it ensured that Lincoln would be reelected.
Right.
So at the Battle of Atlanta really had a tremendous impact. You could say, after the Battle of Atlanta, you could now see the end of the war. You couldn't really say that after Gettysburg. Yes, it was a tremendous bolt in terms of morale for the South, but it didn't end the war, and obviously, because the South fought on for nearly 2 years more. But after Atlanta, it would be much more difficult to mount a campaign against Union armies.
And that victory coming just a few weeks before the election may have had somewhat of an effect on the election itself.
It had a tremendous effect. And then when you combine that with General Phil Sheridan, Union General Phil Sheridan's victories in the Valley of Virginia, which was the other breadbasket feeding the Southern armies. You know, they say an army travels on its stomach. That is so true.
Oh, yeah.
And if you don't have food, it's not really going to be possible. And the other alternative was to just feed off the land, and then you lose support of the local population. So it became very difficult after Atlanta and after the Valley campaign for the Confederacy to sustain itself. And it proved that Lincoln was a good commander-in-chief, and it ensured his reelection.
Yeah, certainly did. And, you know, we could talk about the Civil War forever. In fact, we've been discussing it for 150 years, a little bit more than that, probably since it started, really, with the election of Lincoln in 1860. We're focused on Gettysburg, 150 years ago, July 1863. Our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is David Goldfield, Robert Lee Bailey, professor of history at the University of North Carolina and author of many books about the Civil War, most recently of America Aflame, which I, again, highly recommend. And, you know, everybody's heard about the Gettysburg Battle, the Gettysburg Address, and just a few days after the victory of the North at Gettysburg came something called the New York Draft Riots. One event, Gettysburg, has been known by every schoolchild in America for 150 years, yet virtually no one has heard about the draft riots in New York City. I wonder why and what this says about myth and reality and memory, and perhaps just since most people are not familiar with the New York City draft riots, just to, if you can give a little bit of a quick synopsis, and was the U.S. Navy actually involved?
You make a very good point, Bert. We don't talk about and we don't remember the New York City draft riots because it's off message. What I mean is that if you're riding in the battle cry of Freedom School, the New York City draft riots are not heroic. They happened in the North, and it tends to muddy the narrative of the Union as the Republic of Virtue and the South as the evil empire, particularly as far as race relations were concerned. The New York City draft riots occurred because the Union Army needed recruits, and so Lincoln had a draft. The Confederacy had a draft, too, so this was not particularly unusual in the time of war. But the fact was that you could buy your way out of a draft by paying $300. And this was okay for, say, middle-class young men, and upper-class young men, but for the thousands of Irish immigrants in the cities of the Northeast, this was impossible.
Right.
And from their perspective, the war had become about slavery, because this was in July of 1863. Mm-hmm. The Emancipation Proclamation had been issued in January of 1863. And they believed that the war was going on and that they were being drafted to protect and preserve this Emancipation Edict. So they blamed African Americans for their plight of going into a war that they really didn't want any part of.
Right.
They had no dog in that fight from their perspective. So what happened was when a recruiting office opened in Lower Manhattan in mid-July of 1863, an Irish, mostly Irish mob burned it, trashed it and burned it, and then went on a rampage, particularly through the city's black neighborhoods,
right,
because, again, they associated African Americans with the reason why they were being drafted. And in the process of rampaging through black neighborhoods, they actually lynched several several blacks. In fact, killed six black residents of New York City. There's a drawing, a very famous illustration of that lynching in New York City. I always enjoy showing it to my students, and I say, "Where is this?" And they say, "Oh, it's Alabama, Mississippi." No, it's New York City. Mm. But it gives you an insight, Bert, into the racial feelings of many Northerners. You know, you talk about the abolition of slavery. Very few Northerners were abolitionists. The vast majority of Northerners believed in white supremacy and wanted nothing to do with black people. So this was not especially unusual. But again, it tends to muddy the narrative, because we tend to divide good and evil, North and South, and this doesn't correspond to what we think of. And as a result, the New York City draft riot is not much talked about. But if you talk to Walt Whitman, he would say, yeah, he didn't want to hear about slavery. He didn't want to hear about black people, because he worked in the hospitals and he saw the agony and he saw the pain that these young soldiers were going through. And he had attributed part of that, at least, to all of this controversy over the issue of slavery.
Yeah, and the pain, the horror, the absolute unthinkable horror, unimaginable horror, it doesn't fit the, you know, what people are seeing, 150 years later, the glory of Gettysburg. What a glorious, romantic time it was. I always find it, I mean, there's the battle enactors. A lot of people like to go out and play soldier. It was an awful battle. And Lincoln, in his speech, the Gettysburg Address, used that phrase, a new birth of freedom. And you point out, David Goldfield, that this was that phrase, a new birth of freedom, was derived from evangelical culture, a nation born again, cleansed of sin. How well did this work out? And how did the war affect America's character in this way? And what about that whole evangelical aspect of it? You know, a nation, a new birth of freedom, a nation born again, cleansed of sin.
As I make clear in the book, evangelical Protestantism played a major role in bringing on the war because it tended to polarize the political debate. Slavery moved from being a political issue to a moral issue, which, of course, made it much more difficult to compromise. You can compromise on political issues, but how do you compromise with sin? And, of course, the answer is you don't. So it made it less likely that the two sides could reconcile. And Lincoln, like many other politicians of the era, frequently used biblical rhetoric. When he talked about a house divided against itself cannot stand, he was quoting or paraphrasing from the book of Matthew in the Bible. And when he talked about a new birth of freedom, of course, evangelicals believe that when you accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, you are, in a sense, born again. And Lincoln was aware how that rhetoric resonated, particularly among the Republican Party, because the Republican Party was primarily an evangelical Protestant party. This was part of the rhetoric of the time. Now, some historians have interpreted that new birth of freedom, meaning that he was referring to slaves. He wasn't. He was referring to this nation that was being reborn, that was being annealed in the fire of war, in the blood of war, mm-hmm. and would come out of it stronger and prouder than ever before. Mm. So that's really what he was referring to when he talked about a new birth of freedom. How did that work out? I guess it worked out all right for the white folks, but for the African Americans, it didn't work out that well. It took 100 years and more for African Americans to attain the basic rights of that freedom.
Yeah, and it does seem, as I believe I got from your book, that a lot of the, after the slavery was officially ended, then a lot of the evangelicals in the North, you know, they figured they had done their job and looked elsewhere. So, hey, too bad for the redemption movement, the anger after Reconstruction. It's an amazing history, the reality. And, you know, everybody knows Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. I mean, how can you be, you know, even a fourth grader not have heard of that? But let me ask you this. Who was the featured speaker at the dedication of the cemetery at Gettysburg?
The featured speaker was Edward Everett, politician, senator, congressman, and vice presidential candidate at one time from Massachusetts. Everett was asked to give the main dedication because he had a reputation of being a fantastic orator. And oratory was very important in those days.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, we didn't have TV right. or radio or movies or anything like that.
So, it's great entertainment.
People would go to hear speeches, even political speeches, if you can believe it, as entertainment.
Right.
The Lincoln-Douglas debates were extremely entertaining. It brought crowds from all over the state of Illinois, for example. Edward Everett had this reputation of being a fantastic orator. And he held the crowd spellbound for nearly 2 hours. And then here comes Lincoln mumbling, and he had this high-pitched voice, and he comes after him, and he says this this very brief but also very eloquent Gettysburg Address. And you know, but it's not true that people just tossed it off and dismissed it. The people who were there and some of the people who wrote about it in the newspapers the following day recognized the importance of the word and recognized the importance of his words at Gettysburg. It's just that Ed Everett had given such a spellbinding oration that it stole some of the thunder. And it's interesting because in this very brief speech, Lincoln says that we won't remember much what we say here today. Well, as you said, every schoolboy and girl memorizes, at least I had to memorize the Gettysburg Address, but we have no clue at all about what Edward Everett had to say during any of those 2 hours that he talked.
And also, do we have a clue as to when Lincoln said that nobody will remember my speech, but everybody will think about the cemetery and what it was about and what they died for? Wrong. It didn't quite happen that way. I wonder why his speech wasn't particularly, as I understand it, well known at the time. It was just sort of an afterthought, I guess. Why did it grow so much over time?
The speech grew over time for a couple of reasons. First, the Union won, and so this was a defining moment at Gettysburg in the dedication of the cemetery. Secondly, Lincoln was assassinated, and in becoming a martyr, he became a martyr for the Union cause because, of course, the assassination occurred just a few days after the surrender at Appomattox. Right. So when you elevate somebody to martyrdom, of course you look at his words, you look at his body of work, of what he said and what he did, to clues to his greatness. And everybody knew by that time, at least, that Lincoln was a great orator, and again, oratory mattered. So they began to cull words and phrases and from his speeches. And the Gettysburg Address really became very prominent, particularly after the Civil War and after Lincoln's assassination.
Yeah, plus it's easy to memorize. Let me ask you this, David Goldfield, again, author of America Aflame, fabulous book about the war. If you really want to have an understanding of what that war was about, let me ask you this. If the memory of war is not uplifting, what happens then? Does the story just not get told?
If the memory of a war is not uplifting, I don't think it has much of an impact on the telling of the war, but it has it can have a significant impact on present public policy. Let's take the Vietnam War, for example. I don't think anybody, regardless of political spectrum, would say that the Vietnam War was uplifting.
Right.
Yet we've raked over the coals of that war pretty thoroughly. Not that we know everything. In fact, we don't know everything about the Civil War. But Vietnam has become almost an icon in public policy. Oh, you don't want to get involved in a land war in Asia. Oh, the domino theory is incorrect. We should never get involved in civil wars. Well, sometimes we follow that, but most of the time we don't. So even when a war is not uplifting, we tend not to follow the lessons of that war, unfortunately.
That's so true. And, a lot of us have by now heard about the Christmas truce in the First World War in the early days, and you've written in your book, to relieve tensions, soldiers on both sides occasionally hailed each other from their entrenchments. They exchanged goods, played games. and, you know, the humanity beside the leaders. You quoted Walt Whitman earlier. He said, the people who like wars ought to be compelled to fight them. Now, that's not a new sentiment, but, you know, the humanity that was there, and yet 800,000 people, young men, died in this horrible, horrible war. And it seems to me it was anything but glorious and romantic. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. Not so. Absolutely not so. I highly recommend to our listeners that you read America Aflame. There's a lot to it. David Goldfield, thank you so much for being with us today as we look at the realities of Gettysburg 150 years ago.
Thank you, Bert.
All right. And well, let's see what we can do to prevent expansion of wars in the future, you know? Thanks very much for listening.
Listen to me. It ain't